nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so thanks for coming and inviting me out to the faculty. So you sort of see the title here. You've heard already. So the order, the presentation is going to talk a little bit first about sort of the thermoelectrics in the field of nanostructured thermoelectrics. I'll talk about heat transport, specifically microscale heat transport, and then talk about the specific thermoelectric properties for the materials that I was taking a look at. So just to start, many of you already know the thermal management is important on many different length scales. So I just picked a few examples from microscale to the nanoscale. So this first one here is a picture of a young man. His name's Garrett Yazzi, and they call him, what was his name? The Junkyard Genius. So what he was trying to do, so he lived in this trailer, and he was trying to develop some kind of heating mechanism for his house because their stove let out a lot of particulates, and that was bad for his sister who had asthma. So I just thought this was a unique story. So he basically went to the junkyard. He got a radiator. He got lots of spray cans, put it in a box, spray painted it black for the radiation, put a fan in it, and was able to heat their house. And I don't know if you guys ever watched Extreme Home Makeover, but he was one of the people who got his family a new home. I did a little bit of research, not a whole lot. I'm Sandy on photovoltaic systems. So as you can see, a photovoltaic system has some radiation effects from the heat and the sun, the radiation coming from the photons. You can have conductive heat losses through the materials, and you can also have convective effects when the wind's blowing. There's important need for cooling on the microscale for computer chips and such. And this one is a thermoelectric application and one of my personal favorites. So this is a watch developed by Seiko, and it has a small thermoelectric element inside of it. And so you can basically use your body heat to run the watch. And then an even smaller scale, so silicon nanowires are being investigated for thermoelectric applications also, and they have diameters on the order of 100 nanometers or so. So my topic has specific application for thermoelectrics. And so historically, thermoelectrics have been used for powering up certain spacecrafts, and this is just a picture of an RTG, or radioisotope thermoelectric generator. And this was taken at the Space Museum in D.C. And one of the statistics that they were talking about, or that the picture came along with, is that it still produces 90% of its initial power after 10 years of usage. So that means these devices are pretty reliable, and they have a pretty good lifetime. Here's just a fun application. Someone just basically put a thermoelectric on near a pot of boiling water and was able to power up a light bulb. Some people use the thermoelectrics for a cooling application as opposed to power generation. And here's just an image of a localized cooling of electronic chips. And another cooling application is some of the automotive industry are using the coolant side of thermoelectrics to put into the seats of vehicles. And the idea is to be able to locally cool your body so you don't use as much air conditioning and gas and so on. So just now let's talk a little bit about thermoelectrics. So one way you can use them as heat engines, as I've mentioned before already. So you basically have a heat source and some kind of heat sink, and you have this, energy generation, energy conversion, where you can get power output of it. So the idea between waste heat recycling or recovery is that you could put on a thermoelectric element, add that on to some kind of exhaust heat or some kind of waste heat, power plants, vehicles, what have you, and be able to utilize a little bit more of that power that's being wasted. And so one example is, here's just a little graph of the typical energy split in gasoline, and roughly 40% of the output gas of the exhaust gas is wasted to waste heat. And so the temperatures of that are around 700 Kelvin. So you can imagine trying to utilize some kind of thermoelectric devices that have their peak performance at 700 K to try to recover some of that energy. And now just talk a little bit about thermoelectrics, sort of how they work. So here's one in power generation mode. So you have a hot side and a cold side, and you typically have two semiconductor elements, one n-type and one p-type. So n-type being excess of electrons, p-type being excess of holes or lack of electrons. So when you apply a resistance, this element across the resistance, you can generate a current, which gives you an output. And how we typically quantify the performance of these devices is you have this thermoelectric figure of merit, Zt. And Zt is proportional to a few intrinsic properties to the materials that you have set up in between, or they call them legs. So the first one is the Seebeck, which is denoted by this S. And you have T, which is your absolute temperature. So your Seebeck is important because it's a squared property. And this typically describes the kind of voltage output that you can get based on the performance of the material. And another property that we have here is the electrical conductivity. So electrical conductivity is related to the joule heating that you have in the elements. And when you have this S squared sigma, this numerator, that's what they call a power factor. So that becomes important and quite difficult to optimize, because when you have a carrier concentration here on this x-axis, you typically have opposing trends in the Seebeck and the electrical conductivity. So ideally, some people say there's a optimal power factor or S squared sigma at a particular carrier concentration. And this last factor down here is thermal conductivity, which is a measure of heat conduction. So you can imagine you want something more insulating so you can keep this hot and cold side as they are and continue that that power output. So this is a figure from 2004, and it describes sort of the state of the art bulk material is the bulk bismuth telluride. And the ZT, or the thermoelectric figure merit, was denoted to be about 1. So within the last 10 years or so, some materials have gotten ZT larger than 1, which is that was a big deal. So one material that was developed was bismuth telluride, antimony telluride, superlattice. So it had a high ZT of about roughly 2.5 at room temperature. And another material lead selenide, lead telluride, nanodot superlattices. So that had a ZT of roughly 1.7 at room temperature. And then another material was developed by Su, was creating a material matrix of the silver lead antimony tellurides that happened to have nanodots sort of embedded within the material matrix. And a more recent description of some of these ZT values as a function of temperature is described here. So these dashed lines describe sort of bulk materials. So for example, this is a P-type silicon germanium bulk, and some work done by Wang Chen's group, the group at MIT, were able to create this what they call nanocomposite bulk. And so for example, this N-type actually, let me talk about. Yeah, this N-type silicon germanium, when they use ball milling and hot pressing method. So they basically put a bunch of materials in, mill it up, and then hot press it and sinter it at a particular temperature for a given amount of time. So they were, I don't know how well you can see this, but they were able to see certain nanoparticles on the order of anywhere from, I don't know, tens to hundreds of nanometers. And this picture in, I don't know, I don't think the resolution's very good, but it basically shows that there's different interfaces in sort of a random direction. And the same was true for, a similar technique was done for bismuth telluride. So here's just a sort of bulk bismuth telluride. And there was a group that did same thing, sintering, ball milling and sintering, and they were able to get ZTs up to 1.5 at lower temperatures. And so most of these materials, when they were able to create a nano composite component in, or a nano compound unit, most of them had a large reduction in thermal conductivity, which was the increase for the figure of merit. So now let's talk a little bit about the mechanisms behind thermal conductivity and how you can manipulate it. So we take a look at phonons, which are quantized lattice vibrations. And typically you can think of a material as a spring mass system. So here you have, So here you have a, mass M with atomic interactions between the masses. And you have some sort of wave you can imagine holding like a slinky. You can, as the vibrations go down, they create these waves within the material. And that would be the transport of phonons. So any kind of change in mass or the material stiffness can change the thermal properties of the material. And so thermal conductivity is typically dependent on the specific heat of the material and the phonon group velocity, which are related to the properties of the material. And it's also dependent on the mean, it's also dependent on the mean free path, which is denoted by here, this L. And mean free path is the average distance a phonon will travel before it scatters. And so we can think of phonons having sort of a wide energy spectrum, and I'll talk a little bit about that later. But if you think of photons, for example, there's a whole color spectrum, and there's lots of different wavelengths of photons transporting as light. So really scattering, which you might have heard of, when you see the sky that's blue, then these long wavelengths that scatter with these particles, the scattering mechanisms with the blue wavelength photons are what sort of create that blue color in the atmosphere. And when you start to, and then when you add different other particles in the air, you sort of cloudy up the atmosphere and you scatter other wavelength of phonons. Well, if we think of something similar for phonons, you also have a different wide distribution of phonon wavelengths. You have short, long, mid wavelengths. And much like sort of Rayleigh scattering, if you have a crystalline material, these atoms, then these short and wavelengths, short and long wavelengths will interact through this material, and the short wavelengths will get scattered by the atoms. So if we add in some slightly larger nanoparticles, they can scatter other wavelengths or mid to long wavelengths. So that's sort of the mechanism that we're going to use to study the thermal properties of nanostructured materials. And just to get an idea of sort of the distribution of phonons and how they relate to temperature, much like a Wien's law for photons, there's sort of a Wien's law for phonons, where you have the maximum or the dominant wavelength of phonons times temperature equals some constant. So you can imagine as you increase the temperature, your dominant wavelength will decrease. And that paves the way for what kind of scattering mechanisms are important at particular temperatures. So for example, at low temperatures, you have these long wavelengths and they start to see boundaries, and that's what they tend to scatter with. So you have this particular trend or increase in thermal conductivity that shows that you have this sort of scattering mechanism occurring. And as you start to reach towards the peak of this, and this is a thermal conductivity of silicon, then you have this defect or impurity patterns, impurity scattering, where phonons will see some kind of defect and preferentially scatter. And as you start to get to much higher temperatures, the phonon, the wavelengths will get smaller and the phonons start to interfere with themselves and create some kind of resistance to the thermal transport. So hence you see this reduction in thermal conductivity. So our focus is mainly to try to decrease this peak that you see here. And that's to, and the idea is to try to introduce some kind of defect or impurity scattering to do so. So the materials that, one of the material systems that we looked at is erbium arsenate nanoparticles that are embedded in indium gallium arsenide. So here you can sort of see the semi-metal structure embedded next to the indium gallium arsenide system. And here's the STEM from Stemmer's group in Santa Barbara. So here's the erbium arsenide, layer right next to an indium gallium arsenide layer. And it just sort of shows that epitaxial growth within the material. And here's a TEM picture. And I don't know how you can see it, but these small nanoparticles on the order of 2 to 5 nanometers are embedded within this material system. And before I go into some of the experimental measurements that we did, I'll just talk a little bit about how we measured it. So here we typically get an as-grown film from our collaborators with a substrate, a thin film on it. So we deposit a oxide layer, and then we'll pattern some kind of a metallic line on it. So we apply a current across this 4-point pattern, and that'll induce Joule heating within this line here. So as you have this Joule heating, you have temperature that's proportional to the resistance within the heating line. So you have this temperature that's also oscillating at the second harmonic. Oh, sorry, you also have the resistance that's oscillating at the second harmonic along with the temperature within the line. So now that you have this current and this resistance, you can read out this voltage between these two inner pads at the first and third harmonic. And our setup has a Locket amplifier that's able to sort of subtract out the first harmonic, and we can read the third harmonic, the 3 omega voltage. So the technique is called 3 omega. So you can read out this voltage that has information about the temperature profile, within the material. And by modeling, you can deduce what the thermal conductivity of the underlying layer is. So for a long time, it was thought that there was a minimum in thermal conductivity for a material system. And so here, this is a picture of material A and material B. And it was thought that when you make an alloy of them, that's the lowest, that's the best you could do in achieving a low thermal conductivity. And so that was known as the alloy limit. And for our material system, here's thermal conductivity versus temperature. This is indium gallium arsenide alloy. So in theory, that used to be the best that we thought we could do. But as we start to introduce some of these nanoparticles, so this, for instance, is there's an indium gallium arsenate matrix, and you have nanoparticles that are layered, so you have these sort of super lattices within the material. And so these are two different experimental curves for these particular material systems, and they just have a different spacing between the particles and a different amount of particle in each layer, but roughly they have the same amount of dopant, erbium arsenide dopant in it. And so as you can see, just by introducing these nanoparticles into the system, we were able to reduce the thermal conductivity by a significant amount. And from that material system, we moved on to where the erbium arsenide is randomly deposited into this material. And that's this red curve here. So it reduced a little bit more, but the important thing is to have the nanoparticles in the material system to reduce thermal conductivity. And then again, going back to what we saw before, the main idea is to scatter a wide variety of phonon lengths in the material. And so when our collaborators measured as values of ZT, we were able to more than double the ZT in this material just by including the nanoparticle systems. But the ZT, unfortunately, was not all that great. So we continued on to do more studies, and we increased the particle concentration to 3% erbium arsenite and indium gallium arsenite. And you could see the reduction is even better. So we changed material systems by adding aluminum to the matrix itself. So we have erbium arsenite embedded in indium gallium aluminum arsenite. And we did a study to see how much we could change the aluminum concentration and how that affects the thermal properties. So here we have just indium gallium arsenite. This is thermal conductivity versus percentage of aluminum. And as when we start to add the aluminum, the thermal conductivity reduces a little bit. And you can imagine that that's due to changes in the material system. Like I said before, changes in mass and what the phonon actually sees is different. But as we change the concentration of aluminum, it doesn't change very much. And we did a comparison study with Yi Kan at University of Urbana-Champaign, Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, and they used the time domain thermoreflectance technique. And so we compared this to measurements of theirs when they had at 0.6 megahertz. And our materials, our experimental setup is a little bit less than 6.6 megahertz, but you could see that roughly the values are similar. So we sort of see this trend in both measurement techniques. And so when we look at it versus temperature, which is sort of the important one, here's we have indium gallium aluminum arsenite without any erbium arsenite in it. And that's sort of our alloy. That's our start with. And as we start to add nanoparticles to it, you can see the 0.3%, there's a large reduction in the thermal conductivity. And as we add a little bit more, there's a subtle reduction in thermal conductivity at higher temperatures. But there's also an improvement, almost a double, of the ZT. So that also shows that a large reduction in thermal conductivity also adds to the large improvement in ZT values. And so here's sort of the best ZT values that we've been able to achieve with this erbium arsenite and indium gallium aluminum arsenite. And so here we have ZT versus temperature, and you can see we've gotten up to about 1.3, 1.4 at close to 800 Kelvin. Right. Oh, sorry. So nominal ZT is, so a ZT of 1 is, so the nominal ZT is the ZT of the material with nanoparticles divided by the material without particles. So ZT with nanoparticles is divided by the ZT without nanoparticles. Okay, so this was sort of the culmination of the material and the data that we had taken when I was there. The other material system that I'll talk just a little bit about was super lattice materials. So in some of the materials we're looking at, we see this, you have a thermal conductivity versus super lattice period. So super lattice period being the distance between the different, or the thickness of the different super lattices. So thickness, you have material A, B, A, B. So it's the thickness of material A and B together is one super lattice period. So some material systems, you see this minimum thermal conductivity as around a low super lattice period. So some groups attribute that to, as you get higher super lattice period, you can imagine that your interfaces start to become important, and the more interfaces, or the different interfaces that you have, will change the thermal properties of the material. So as you have more interfaces or a smaller superlattice period, you'll have more scattering, and that'll reduce the thermal conductivity. So you can see that trend as this goes down this way. Decrease in thermal conductivity as the superlattice period increases at low temperatures is seen in some material systems. So some people attribute that to having the phonons not being able to transport as particles, but you have to look at them as waves. And they can have interference, and they can interfere with each other. and that'll create a reduction in thermal conductivity as you increase the superlattice period. So that's just a few concepts that explain sort of that minimum in thermal conductivity. And the material systems that we looked at were collaborative with Professor Sand's group here. And they're the zirconium nitride, scandium nitride, metal semiconductor superlattices, or multilayers. So here's just a TEM I took from one of their papers published in 2009. And you can sort of see the interfaces of the different material layers. And well, sort of their explanation for, in the next slide, I'll show sort of these also that minimum in thermal conductivity. So, one of their explanations was when they measured thermal conductivity versus temperature, there's in a very thin material sample, you have a rapid rise in thermal conductivity. And so they attribute that to being, the thermal conductivity due to electrons as being the dominant mechanism. So, and I didn't explain earlier, but thermal conductivity is broken up into two components typically. So you have one that's due to the lattice thermal conductivity. You have other that's a contribution of electrons. And so here they sort of attribute this minimum in period thickness to the dominance in electrical conductivity. So this is just a picture of a graph of thermal conductivity versus period thickness. And again, we compare some of these measurements to the time domain thermoreflectance technique, which is shown by these open circles. And our 3 omega technique was by these filled circles here. But the main concept I want you to take away is that the thermal conductivity for scandium nitride is roughly 10.6, and that of zirconium nitride is about 47. So the combination of the superlattice is far below both of those values. And so in the spirit of trying to modify the material even further to try to get a larger reduction, they also took a look at adding a heavier particle, a heavier mass. So you can imagine in a spring when you have a heavy mass, it's a little bit harder to transport or to move the spring. So to do that, there was a tungsten doping inside of a zirconium nitride layer. So this is one sample that we had gotten, and it was initially meant to be a super lattice of scandium nitride and then the tungsten doped zirconium nitride. Unfortunately, we had one of the targets ran out, so we have a super lattice with a small amount of tungsten doped zirconium nitride. But the reduction in thermal conductivity when you add the tungsten doping is very obvious. You have a large reduction. And so this technique of trying to add a heavier material or atom within the matrix is very useful in reducing the thermal conductivity even further. And so just studies, this is again an image from the paper written in 2009. This is thermal conductivity versus the percentage of tungsten in the material. And so you could see just adding tungsten reduces the thermal conductivity even further than just zirconium nitride. And so that sort of goes along with the previous observation that when we add aluminum to our indium gallium arsenide, it also means a large reduction in that thermal conductivity. But as you increase that concentration of that foreign atom, then it doesn't really change the thermal conductivity very much beyond that. And I'm not sure how I'm doing on time, actually. Okay. Oh, okay. All right. So I'll just finish here. So the main thing I was trying to get across, I don't know how well, probably didn't do it very well, but is that nanostructures are very key and important inhibiting thermal transport across the material. And again, that's due to scattering different wavelengths of phonons. And so scattering the nanoparticles in our material system were very effective at scattering mid to long wavelength phonons, while these atomic inclusions in the material are good at scattering the short wavelength phonons. And as shown by a few of the material systems, any changes in mass or changes that the phonon sees while it transports through the material makes an effective method of reducing thermal conductivity. So with that, I'll say thank you and questions.
For the composite material that you made with the randomly dispersed nanoparticles, how did you actually process that material? What kind of technique did you use?
So that material was made at UC Santa Barbara under Art Gossard's group. So the particular growth mode is what they call Weber. I don't know if I'm saying that right. And the idea is that as it's an MBE system, so you have, let's say, indium, gallium, arsenite, erbium all being deposited at the same time. And the way that the material is, the erbium tends to want to be with the arsenite, and it has something to do with the solubility of some of the atoms within the material matrix itself. And so they're sort of self-assembled as you grow the material. Does that help?
But how do you get the nanoparticle inclusions? Those self-assemble?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is this also the reason why you grow these erbium arsenide layers or particles in a regular manner? I mean, as far as I understood, you want to use those heavy mass materials to reduce, to lower the string constant, or to increase it. Maybe I confused that. But there is no specific reason to have it grown in a regular manner? Looking for a phonon confinement or something?
Why we grow it in sort of an...
I mean, you have shown super lattices.
Right.
And also before I've seen erbium, I think it was erbium clusters or something, in a rather regular manner. And I just wonder why they have to be distributed in a regular manner, not just randomly.
You mean this?
Yeah,
this one. This is in the stage when we were still trying to understand the phonon dynamics of everything. And this is just how the material was grown for, I believe, for some of the electronic measurements. And so what the growing team usually do is they make a bunch of wafers, they give everybody a piece of it, and what's one group might want to optimize, maybe not necessarily another group wants to. So, but we all support each other's measurements. So this is how the project started, is trying to do some kind of energy filtering mechanisms. And so in sort of just playing around with the growth of the material, the next sort of step that was taken was just to grow this was to grow the randomly distributed mode and not really being sure which one would be the best growth technique. Sorry.
You've mentioned that energy filtering across the barriers. Do you have approaches or are there approaches that also try nonlinear transport? So you could also, you could also filter with respect to electronic or maybe even phononic energy when you are lower than the barrier height.
Mm-hmm.
Resonant tunneling, for example, does it as well. Are there approaches for that or not yet?
Approaches for resonant tunneling in for the phonon material, as far as tunneling, some groups have hypothesized that that's what happens at short super lattice periods, for example. For the electronic part, I'm not as familiar with it.
I mean, it's often used, you know, for just nano devices. I mean, if you have Cascad lasers, for example, that are regularly used since, I think, maybe 15 years or something, but just for emitting light and not for cooling reservoirs or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that might be a very interesting approach to try that. Of course, maybe then you cannot use CT as a figure of merit. Okay, but you're not aware of that.
No.
So in the last system, the zirconium nitride scandium nitride system, the thermal conductivity is mainly dominated by electrons because it's several times and keeps on linearly increasing. Is that the thermal?
That was the outcome of the paper. That was their hypothesis. Is that? Is it there, since there was such a dramatic change in temperature, or dramatic change in thermal conductivity with temperature, that?
And then tungsten is added primarily to decrease the phonon thermal conductivity, or is it also to bump up the electrical conductivity, or to use doping to increase?
Well, my discussions with the grower, it was in lieu of the phonon part, but.
So you do show that there is a huge decrease in thermal conductivity, like from several tens to maybe of the order of 4 or, you know, a few watts per meter Kelvin. And if it is indeed electronically dominated, then I guess I didn't really understand what effect is being, you know, suppressed. Is it the phonon thermal conductivity, or is it just that the properties itself are changing because of the doping? Or? Yes, here you show several tens, and then I think later on you show a few, maybe 3 to 4 watt meter Kelvin or so.
Okay, these are different. Maybe I didn't make that clear. So this one is actually a study of the tungsten doping, but also has different period thicknesses. So this one, for example, there's 6 nanometers between each successive period. The other one I think I showed was has a very small period thickness, so it's on the order of 1. So they're 2 different material systems. You can, and then this one. So I didn't show any other thermal conductivity versus temperature, but yeah. So since it's a different system, sorry, I don't have. And again, this one is also a different period thing, so it's hard to compare directly one graph to another, but I guess the main idea is that it's based on some of the other measurements that were done. The large increase in the thermal properties is a little bit unusual, so that was sort of one hypothesis.
And is that consistent across all these metal semiconductor superlattices, or is that only for the very low period?
Only for the very low period, yeah. And so that's sort of below, I don't know, maybe. Yeah. Yeah, sort of below, yeah, the 5 nanometer range.
Okay, move to the nanoparticle composite material.
Yep.
I noticed your group lowers the thermal conductivity effectively at around 200K, right? Around 200K. So at what temperature your group got the highest TE?
So for this I don't remember for this material system. This one is without aluminum, and the ZT was so low. But for the
you showed the nominal ZT at 800, right?
Right.
But I noticed at 800, you guys didn't lower the sum of connectivity very much.
Right. So that was
adding point defect that will lower the reduce the electromobility, also reduce the electrical conductivity.
Right. So it was in the idea based on the energy filtering mechanism. Yes, the thermal conductivity didn't change very much at high temperatures. The thermal conductivity reduces by a factor of 2, let's say from 400 to 800. And then when we go here from 400 to 800, so the factor of 2, let's say the thermal conduction would bring up the ZT to about here. And then the remaining part was due to the electrical, the improvement in the electrical or the power factor. And the, again, it's attributed to the energy filtering and how you can, try to modify that. They call it band engineering, and how you can try to optimize the transport of electrons based on the band gaps and materials that you have.
My question is slightly away from the materials perspective. There has also been some work about adding nanostructures to improve the efficiency of thermal photovoltaics. So I was just wondering, at a given temperature, do these thermoelectric devices significantly outperform photovoltaics with nanostructures?
I'm not that familiar with the thermal photovoltaics part. But
for example, in Yangcheng's group,
right,
MIT, they have shown that these nanostructures, because they can alter thermal emission, they can increase the efficiency of these thermal photovoltaic devices. So I was just wondering whether at a certain temperature this significantly outperforms.
I'm not sure, but I mean, for different temperatures, if you're talking about specific material systems, I don't know on a comparison basis. But the idea of trying to use different materials, so the idea of trying to use different materials is that in theory you can stack up these different thermoelectric materials, right? So you have hot and cold. The highest temperature performing material will be near the hot side. Stack up, let's say, like silicon germanium on lead telluride on bismuth telluride materials. I don't know how the performance of the thermal photovoltaics is.
One last question, and then we'll let folks go. You've also worked in field-deployed energy systems. So in that context, these materials are, many of them are exotic, expensive, and rare. How many of these, or which material system do you think, aside from the ZT, has the best chance of being deployed at large?
I think as far as being commercially upgradable, manufacturable, probably the nano composite bulk materials, so where they can the ball milling, sintering, just to try to adjust the grain size. Compared to MBE growth, where it can take a long time for monotonic layers to be laid down, it seems to be a lot simpler, and the ZTs aren't so bad. They have taken, I know some of them have taken tens of measurements of the same, maybe not the same ingot, but differently grown ingots that they create, and they report the values don't change very much, and they're pretty fairly repeatable within, 5-10%. So I think that's probably the most easily manufacturable. But the materials that we studied were very useful in sort of understanding the the physical properties and of the particles and nanostructures and how that affects the transport.
Let's thank our speaker.